Je suis donc ravie de vous accueillir pour le début des séminaires de cette année qui sont donc associés à mon cours. Ce sont des séminaires qui avaient été initialement programmés l'année dernière. Et comme je l'ai expliqué lors du premier de mes cours, jeudi dernier, j'avoue que l'année dernière, je n'ai pas voulu ajouter des webinaires aux captations vidéo parce que je trouvais que c'était vraiment trop, et donc j'ai préféré, avec l'accord de mes invités, reporter tout à cette année et avoir des séances en présence où on puisse discuter autrement que par écran interposé, même si les écrans nous ont bien dépannés pendant tout ce temps, cette période si difficile. Donc, j'aurai le plaisir d'accueillir aujourd'hui donc deux collègues, deux intervenants, et la première, c'est Josine Bloch, une amie de longue date, et Josine nous vient des Pays-Bas, où elle a mené toute sa carrière. Elle a été surtout professeure d'histoire antique à l'Université d'Utrecht jusqu'en 2019. Elle est donc maintenant ce qu'on appelle une retraitée active, très active même. Je soulignerai aussi, parce que ça me semble très important, qu'elle a été doyenne de sa faculté, elle a été présidente de son département. Donc Josine est quelqu'un qui s'est beaucoup investi dans les tâches collectives au sein de son institution. Et je pense que cet investissement dans le collectif n'est pas sans lien finalement avec les sujets d'études que l'on choisit. Elle est aussi la fondatrice du European Network for the Study of Ancient Greek History, qui a maintenant 20 années d'existence, elle en est la fondatrice et l'animatrice principale, et donc c'est un groupe de chercheurs sur l'histoire ancienne qui a eu l'occasion de publier pas mal de collectifs particulièrement intéressants. Josine a reçu de nombreux prix, je vous les épargnerai, des allocations de recherche aussi pour des programmes tout aussi collectifs qui ont été extrêmement importants. Sur le point des publications, elle a évidemment écrit de très nombreux articles. Je mentionnerai dans le registre des livres l'ouvrage tiré de sa thèse de doctorat sur les Amazones dans la représentation mythique du passé des cités de l'Asie mineure, des directions de collectifs nombreuses dont j'épinglerai juste le collectif sur Solon, qui a été publié avec André Lardinois, et dont j'aurai l'occasion de parler à ceux qui auront le courage de venir au cours jeudi, j'aurai l'occasion d'en parler puisque je vais commencer un cours sur Solon. Et puis surtout, parce que là nous arrivons au creux de notre sujet d'aujourd'hui, sa dernière monographie intitulée « Citizenship in Classical Athens », qui a été publiée à Cambridge en 2017 et qui rassemble, si je ne me trompe, deux lignes de force des intérêts nombreux de Josine Bloch, à savoir l'intérêt pour l'histoire des femmes et l'intérêt pour l'histoire institutionnelle, politique. Et donc, au croisement de ces deux intérêts se situe notamment la présentation d'aujourd'hui, et je lui cède donc tout de suite la parole. Merci Josine.
Merci beaucoup pour tes mots très gentils. Et d'abord, je veux remercier très cordialement professeur Vincent Pirène-Delforge pour son invitation généreuse et remercier vous tous pour me permettre de parler en anglais dans cette cathédrale des sciences humaines de la France. J'avoue que pour moi, parler en anglais est beaucoup plus facile qu'en français. Donc maintenant, je continue en anglais. Professor Biren proposed that I do two things in this talk: to discuss my views on the religious foundations of citizenship in classical Athens, as laid out in my book of 2017 that she just mentioned, and to use this occasion to respond to two French critics of my work. Bringing the two topics together, I will first discuss what citizenship is, what it means in general, and what it meant in ancient Greece. Next, I turn to the gods,
to clarify why and how religion was crucial to citizenship in classical Athens. And after this, I can respond to my two critics. Citizenship is a meta-historical concept. This means that definitions of the concept capture what is essential and common to all varieties of citizenship across history. Political scientist Maarten Vink provides such a definition, and I quote, "Citizenship is a constitutive element of political community, consisting of membership of this community and the benefits, rights, and duties attached to that status," end of quote. Citizenship, then, consists of two components, membership of the group of citizens and the contents of this membership, what it means for what individual citizens may or should do. The two components are inextricably linked. The status of being a member of the group is the condition for getting the benefits, rights, and duties. Vink mentions benefits because some prerogatives of citizenship are not exactly rights or duties. For instance, as citizens of France, most of you are who are sitting here, you have the right to vote for the presidency and Assemblée of France and the duty to take taxes in France. But you have also other benefits. For instance, your French passport allows you to travel in and out of France. You receive the benefits of the French welfare state and the advantages of the European Union, such as access to the Erasmus exchange program. Next, Vink adds to his definition other observations, and I quote, "Citizenship is closely entwined with the self-determination of political communities, typically based in a permanently inhabited territory. For political self-determination to be possible, the conception of membership, that is, of the group entitled to the benefits and rights of the political community, needs to be stable," end of quote. Vink points out that citizenship is not only an essential component of political community, but that it is interdependent with its self-determination. If the political community is to maintain sufficient salience, there must be a solid conception of who the citizens are who hold the benefits, rights, and duties. If these benefits are open to just anybody, they lose their social and legal meaning and are economically unaffordable. Citizenship, therefore, always needs social boundaries and rules of membership. Fink's definition is generic. That is, it is relevant for a wide variety of political communities. It defines the nexus, the connection, between membership and prerogatives common to all systems. However, the kinds of rules of membership and of rights and duties of citizenship vary immensely as to time and place. Today, access to citizenship is usually based on birth, and among the rights are equality in the law and political agency. But historically, this has certainly not been the case. For instance, in the cities of early modern Europe, citizenship could be bought for money, and it held economic rights and legal protection, but no equality and no political entitlements. For citizenship in ancient Greece, the notion rights itself is not always adequate. Rights are general, formal entitlements that an individual can claim in law and are enforceable in court. In Greece, very few claims had the level of abstraction, generality, and enforceability belonging to the notion rights. Although the Greek polis developed extensive legal systems, the laws left more leeway for negotiation than applies to modern rights. Christel Müller, in her work on Hellenistic citizenship, therefore prefers to replace rights and duties by the term spheres of action. I think that this term covers the situation well, but that it's not easy to use, especially in a comparative perspective. So although the terms are not really adequate, For the sake of simplicity, I'll speak here of rights and duties, with inverted commas all the time, belonging to membership. So, returning to the general definitions, let us gather the main points. The two components, membership and rights and duties, are inextricably connected. Being a member means having these rights. The nexus between them is usually set in formal rules, notably laws. The conception of membership needs to be stable, so there must be rules of access to membership. How does one become a citizen? And conversely, how or when does a citizen lose membership? Furthermore, it must be clear which rights and duties belong to membership, and if they are the same for all citizens or not. And conversely, if a citizen can lose such prerogatives. While thus both components and the nexus between them are defined by formal rules, they are also deeply embedded in norms and values. Although such norms and values are informal, they have a strong effect in society and become particularly powerful when something special is at stake. For instance, when an outsider is to be admitted to citizen status. We'll see some examples of this later. I now turn to ancient Greece. Using the general definition, let us first look at membership. Across ancient Greece, the stable conception of membership of the polis was based on birth from a citizen parent. Citizenship thus became an inherited status, originally only shaped by rituals and customs. Around 600 BCE, membership by descent was laid down in laws with a growing body of rights and duties attached to it. The laws made clear distinctions between citizens and others and settled the inheritance rights of citizens. At first, one parent of citizen status sufficed, but in the classical age, many polis tightened the criterion to two citizen parents. Yet outsiders could become insiders, citizens, in several ways. First, in the archaic age, membership of cultic, social, or professional associations and settlement in the territory could gradually lead to inclusion. Such a process was probably most successful when supported by intermarriage, with access to citizenship for one's children. On the other hand, endogamy, marriage within one's own community or polis, was a strong value in Greece, making marriage with outsiders unattractive. Second, when colonies were founded or existing polis were refounded, outsiders were usually included as new citizens. And third, when citizenship by descent had become firmly consolidated in law from around 500 BC onward, citizen status was given to outsiders as a grant, usually to individuals, occasionally to collectives. And finally, in the Hellenistic age, some polis sold their membership to outsiders. These were extraordinary measures taken to fill the depleted treasuries of these polis. Let us now look at some of the relevant laws. In Athens, citizenship had been formally based on descent since the laws of Solon of 594. Children born from one Athenian parent, usually the father, were accepted as legitimate members of the family and of the polis by a series of rituals overseen by the fratres. After 5087, when Cleisthenes refounded the citizen body and drafted a new constitution, citizen status of children was more strictly checked for legitimacy, first by the fratres and for males by the deems, new polis subgroups. In 451, to zero, Pericles' citizenship law laid down that two Athenian-born parents were required for citizen status. In the Peloponnesian War of 431 to 4, this law was allowed to relapse but in 403(2) it was reinstated. To the contents of this law, I'll return shortly. Pericles' law made intermarriage even less attractive for Athenians, and formal grants of citizenship became, in effect, the regular way for outsiders to membership. In other polis, we see roughly the same historical pattern. Citizenship was based on descent, first by tradition only, and over time formally regulated in law. Sometimes one parent was required for citizen status, sometimes two. The rule of two citizen parents became quite common in the classical age. Such citizenship systems were only possible if men and women were both of citizen status. This quite logical fact is confirmed in the Greek language, which has symmetrical masculine and feminine forms of the words for a citizen, politeis and politis, ostos and oster, and the ethnic names, for instance, Athenaios and Athenaia. We see a clear example in a decree from Thasos from around 400. It rules that citizens of its former colony who descended from Thasian women were citizens of Thasos too. Clearly, Thasian citizen status could be transmitted through women as well as through men. Let us now look at the benefits, rights and duties belonging to membership. In Athens, no extant law offers a list of such benefits and rights, but a court speech quotes the reenactment of Pericles' citizenship law I mentioned before with an important statement. And I quote, "For according to the law, no male or female nothos," usually translated as bastard, it is a bit wrong, but okay, let's keep it like this, "has any claim based on kinship on either side," that's in the word archisteia, "to a share in Hiera kai Hosia as of the archonship of Euclides of 403(2). End of quote. The negative phrasing, "no one has not," seems odd today, but was very common in antiquity. What the expression Hiera kai Hosia means, I'll explain in a minute. I first want to observe that the law restricts citizenship to legitimate children of Athenian citizens on both sides. Second, the law captures the benefits of citizenship for both men and women in a generic expression about a share. Not just in Athens, but in Greek polis generally, decrees and other texts describe the benefits of citizenship as sharing. For instance, sharing in everything the citizens share. Clearly, membership of the group of citizens means having things collectively. And conversely, sharing these things is crucial to the citizens' status as a collective. Given that legitimate descent was the legal condition for citizen status, the things they share get the quality of a common inheritance. And this is confirmed by the words of this law. The archisteia, I mentioned the word before, comprised the families on both sides relevant to the transmission of inheritance. Citizenship in Greece, then, for membership, means being the legitimate heir to one share of ancestral common heritage, the patroia. And having a share also means being actively involved in all of this. This heritage includes the territory of the polis, the common traditions, the so-called nomima of the polis, with all its political and societal institutions, the politeia. And last but not least, it means sharing in hiera, in Athenian law, the hiera kai hosia. And this is where the gods come in. In Athens, the benefits of citizen status are indicated by sharing in ta hiera kai ta koina, that is the common things, and sharing in hiera kai hosia. We just saw hiera kai hosia in the law on citizenship, and it occurs, this expression occurs in many other texts, as the benefit of membership of the household, the oikos, and of the polis. One such text is a speech written by Demosthenes in the mid-4th century, in which he denounces the conduct of a certain Charidamos, a mercenary captain who had received Athenian citizenship some years before, and I quote, "It was we, men of Athens, who made Charidamos a citizen, a polites, and by that gift bestowed upon him a share in our hierarchy, hosia, in our traditions, our nomima, and in everything of which we are entitled to have a share." End of quote. So what then are hierarchy hosia? First, tahira. Tahira was an umbrella term for things set aside for the gods. Normally, hieros designated what belonged to the gods as a gift from humans. Tahira captured a great variety of such gifts, primarily animal sacrifice, libations, and other offerings, but also votives of many kinds, hymns and songs, dances, musical and athletic competitions, plots of land, buildings, and money. The noun hieron usually referred to a sanctuary, a building or other designated place to serve the gods. By extension, tahira could mean the entire process of honoring, consecrating, and gift-giving to the gods. In other words, the cult of the gods. Essential to tahira is what they mean and do. They are human gifts to the gods in a chain of gratitude and obligation for the gift of the gods of their divine powers. Humans toiled to achieve what they wanted, but they needed the divine powers such as fertility, courage, justice, victory, to make their efforts effective. For their contributions, the gods expected fitting honors, gratitude, and rewards in the form of gifts and of the effort to produce these gifts, for instance, a so-called first share of the produce. Hera engendered charis, something like warm feelings among the gods towards the human givers. Most scholars characterize the relationship between ancient Greeks and their gods as reciprocity, and that is largely correct. Yet the gods were immortal and humans mortal, and the gifts of the gods were inevitably much greater than humans could ever return. The relationship between humans and gods was thus infinitely more unequal than in reciprocity between humans. Due to this insurmountable hierarchy, humans expressed their deep gratitude towards the gods, but also a sense of debt. Tahira were both the means and the focus of commonality, because sharing in hiera meant sharing in honoring the gods in cults. Sharing in animal sacrifice was the core religious act, which simultaneously created a vertical connection between humans and gods by the offering, and a horizontal connection among the human worshippers sharing the meat. Festivals, cultic festivities, and competitions, often with a sacrifice as a central event, were likewise a moment of sharing with the gods and other humans. Besides festivities, taking oaths was important for the polis, because oaths grounded social ties between humans in hiera, in the shape of animal sacrifice or libation. Breaking an oath crucially damaged one's relations with the humans and gods involved. Finally, humans offered their gifts as individuals and as a household, but it was the polis as the collective of all its members which anchored, legitimated, and mediated most religious actions, as Christiana Sorvino Inwood put it. The reciprocity enacted in this exchange forged a bond, the beginning of which belonged to the imagined origins of the polis. The gods' long-standing engagement with the polis was captured in the expression that the gods held the polis as its protectors and as the beneficiaries of its gifts. in sum, among all the levels of communal cultic relationships, from individual cults up to Panhellenic sanctuaries, the bond of the polis with the gods was the most salient and durable. In a way, it formed a covenant between polis and gods. Now, Tahosia. Tahosia means literally Hosios things, and this cannot be translated directly in any modern language. Hosios is the adjective of Hosia, a noun that may be translated tentatively by pious respect. It captures a range of religious and social norms: respect for the gods, for close kin, for guests, refugees and suppliants, and for the dead. The gods are the guardians of Hosea, and when humans comply with Hosea, this gives pleasure to the gods. Tahosia are Hosios things, that is, material goods used for Hosea, and thoughts and acts according to Hosea. Hosios goods are, for instance, private or public property used for sacrifice. Hosios' conduct towards humans honors the gods because it pays respect to humans, such as care for aging parents, burial of the dead, and keeping oaths. Between polis, Hosea entailed conventions regarding warfare and treaties, notably pious treatment of the dead, keeping oaths, and respect for each other's hiera. Hosea was a set of unwritten rules or laws transcending the actual laws of individual polis and even the cultural boundaries of the Greek world. In the context of religious cult and ritual, Hosea meant the rules of the cult which created the ties between the worshipping group and the divinity. These rules were valid for this particular cult and the specific group, be it small or large. Here in particular, we find the connection between Hosea and Hiera in the rules of ritual, many of which were inscribed. A wonderful collection of such rules is being made in a project led by Professor Pirene Delforge, a collection of Greek ritual norms that you see here, the opening site of the project with all the texts. All these rules illuminate the range of issues involved in Hosea, but in fact they were one set of values sustaining durable relations between humans and gods. As Saskia Peels, who will speak here next week, has shown, all Hosea supports long-term reciprocity between humans and gods, including relations between humans under divine guidance. To our findings about citizenship so far, we now add the benefits belonging to membership, sharing in Hiera, the gifts given in gratitude to the gods in the cycle of reciprocity, and in Hosea, all human actions and property used to please the gods. The expression Hiera kai Hosea synoptically represents the bond between humans and gods, on which the well-being of the human community depended, its territory, customs, and institutions. Sharing in Hiera kai Hosea was a common expression in Athens and in a few other polis. Elsewhere, it was called sharing in Hiera. Both expressions indicate what was central to the polis as a community and the prime benefit of citizenship. What did this mean in practice? The polis as a whole was responsible for keeping the bond with the gods in good order. I mention just a few aspects. Meetings of the council, the assembly, and the jury courts were sanctified by sacrifice, oaths, and prayers, involving the gods as guardians of the procedures. Inscribed decrees were set up in sanctuaries to address both the citizens and the divine guardians. The gods were considered to contribute actively to the process of legislation, as we see in the heading Theoi, or Theos, of inscribed decrees. You see an example here, and Rebecca van Hoven will discuss this phenomenon next week. Directly relevant for citizenship is how the citizens participated in the common hiera as part of their benefits, rights, and duties. In the participation in the polis, we must distinguish between a baseline open to all citizens and a higher level consisting of the police officers. At the baseline, all citizens, male and female, were expected to participate in the police cults, the hiera in the widest sense. Doing so was both a right and a duty belonging to citizen status, and vice versa, sharing in the hiera of the family and the polis demonstrated one's identity as a citizen. The latter fact is borne out by court cases where defendants who were accused of not being of citizen status proved their legitimate descent by demonstrating they had shared in the hiera of the family, the polis and its subgroups, in the case of men especially, of the fratries. We'll see an example of this shortly in the case of a certain Euxithios. All the rituals, sacrifices and festivals were organized according to gender and age. The rules for the composition of the groups sharing cults and for the ways in which each group was to participate were established by law or custom, and all belonged to Hosier. There were special cultic roles for younger women, such as the kaneforoi, who went in front of religious processions, and religious competitions for boys and young men. In some cults and festivals, distinction as to gender and age was the leading principle. In others, men and women participated together, but in different roles. In the domain of politics, gender distinction prevailed. For politics, at the baseline, all men accepted as legitimate citizens in the deems at 18 years of age could participate in deem meetings and in the polis assembly. From the age of 30, all citizen men could present themselves for serving in the jury courts. Other offices required further distinctions and represented a higher level of citizens' prerogatives. Over time, Athens implemented the equality of the citizens by lowering the thresholds, raising the qualifications of the demos, and increasing participation by drawing lots and rotation. With an estimated of 1,200 officers, plus several thousand in the jury courts, democratic Athens had an unparalleled number of political offices open to all male citizens. In public offices, men and women were active in different roles. All public offices collectively were called timai, meaning honours, a subgroup of which were also called archai, usually translated as political offices. But all archai also had duties in the domain of cult. Other timai were typically offices for cult alone, notably priesthoods. Archai clearly had authority over other citizens, notably male citizens, to a degree that cultic timai did not. Only men had access to archai, while women and men had both access to cultic offices, dependent on the cult. The number of priesthoods for adult men and women may have been roughly equal. Cultic offices, such as priesthoods, but also the highest offices, the archonships, were only open to citizens born from two Athenians. In sum, we have found that citizens were members of the polis based on descent. For benefits, rights, and duties, at the baseline, male and female citizens participated equally in cult, and men had access to the assembly. In polis offices, men overwhelmingly prevailed because of their access to the archai. In Athens, the high level of participation in office was typical of the radical democracy. However, in the moderate democracies in Greece, only a modest number of men participated in the political offices. In oligarchies, even fewer men held office, and the assembly and courts had been largely abolished. In such polis, all other male and female citizens were still citizens in terms of membership, but they had no political rights, but they had participation in cults. The historical practices of citizenship in ancient Greece that I have sketched for you now were quite different from the famous definition of the citizen that Aristotle provides in the Politics and I quote, "A citizen, a politesse, without further qualifications, is defined by nothing more than sharing actively, met egheng, is here a verb, in judicial office, crisis, and political office, arche." End of quote. Aristotle's definition of the citizen fits the theoretical purposes of the politics to find the conditions for the best possible polis. For him, the stability of the polis depended on the political structure, for which membership by descent was not a reliable guideline. Neither did he consider religion an important factor for political stability. The power of the gods is omnipresent and eternal, beyond human analysis, while the stability of the polis has to do with different human interests and powers that can be understood. Aristotle created a definition that suited his theoretical argument, distinct from the historical practices he saw around him. Most historians, however, have understood Aristotle's argument to be a shorthand of the historical realities of citizenship in Greece. It is beyond any doubt that political life was enormously important in the Greek polis. However, considering the historical evidence more widely, we find that Aristotle's definition takes the part of political office to be the whole of citizenship, and that he removes the factor membership from it. In fact, Aristotle takes it for granted, but without defining membership, citizenship does not exist. Furthermore, his definition eliminates religion as an essential domain of the polis and of participation of citizens. This means that he eliminates the citizenship of most men in moderate democracies and oligarchies and of all women in all polis, despite the fact that in Greek law and language they were all citizens too. And this takes me to my two French critics. Pierre Frölich wrote an extensive article to criticize not just my arguments, but also the viewpoints of two colleagues, Christel Müller and Violaine Sibiotte-Cuchet. Ivan Savalli-Lestrade reviewed my book. Violaine Sibiotte wrote a response of her own to Frölich's article, and I respond now for myself alone. Frölich's article reveals that he largely misunderstands what I am saying. I would need to show this in detail, and it is tempting to do so because throughout he seeks to disqualify my work in a rather offensive manner. However, for principle and practical reasons, I will not do so, but instead I will explain the problem in a few points. Frölich, like me, argues that Aristotle's definition is a philosophical one, but, unlike me, he contends that Aristotle's definition fits historical reality. According to Frölich, holding political office was the essence of citizenship, from which descent as criterion for citizen status was derived. If I transpose his contention to the present day, it means that your right to elect the president of France is the essence of your citizenship, and that from this right, your status as a citizen of France and being married under French law, for instance, is derived. It is a topsy-turvy conception. Court speeches are important evidence for my view on citizenship, and Frölich tries to disprove my arguments by claiming that I read these texts in a wrong way and with unfounded assumptions. To begin with his first objection, he claims I do not take the purpose of such speeches into account. According to Frölich, when Demosthenes refers to the citizenship of Charidemos, I gave you this quote before, as sharing in the Hiera and Hosia, the orator is only exaggerating to create a contrast. But Hiera and Hosia have nothing to do with real citizenship, according to Frölich. However, I do take the purpose of these speeches into account, but in a way Frölich overlooks, namely that the orators wanted to win their cases. Hence, they had to tap into the common knowledge, principles, values, and expectations of their audience. Demosthenes certainly creates a contrast, but his reference to Hira and Hosea could only work if his audience would recognize this notion as a familiar and vital aspect of citizenship. And this was clearly the case, notably laid down in the Athenian law we saw earlier. This is a fact with consequences for understanding citizenship that Froelich refuses to acknowledge. An important case for my view is Demosthenes 57, the defense speech of a certain Euxithios I briefly mentioned earlier. This man was accused of not being of legitimate Athenian descent, and therefore he was removed from the list of citizens. In his appeal to prove that he was a citizen, Euxithios calls witnesses to the citizen status of his parents and to his own participation in the hiera of the family and polis. He does not flag holding a political office, except that of Demarchos, that allegedly got him into his present trouble. Froelich claims that this speech says nothing about Athenian citizenship, with four arguments that you see briefly quoted here. I took just one line with the essence from his article. First, he contends that the speech, which does not reflect Aristotle's definition, provides no definition of citizenship at all, and therefore that my argument that this speech does provide such a definition is based on an unfounded assumption. Apparently, Froelich only recognizes as a definition an abstract, general definition such as scholars produce. What a society defines as crucial and lays down in law, here concerning citizenship, is not a definition for him. His idea of what a definition is seems to me quite unusual and in any case has lost contact with the scholarship on citizenship. Second, Froelich claims that because Euxithios tried to prove his legitimate descent by participation in Hiera, his was just a singular case that says nothing about citizenship in general. First, the logic in this claim is unclear. Why is it a priori unlikely that this case has a more general bearing? Second, Froelich's claim is highly unlikely, because Euxithios is fighting for his life and liberty here and will advance arguments that must win his case. If he came up with proofs that the court would not recognize as valid for citizenship in general, he would be in severe trouble. And third, Froelich's statement is historically incorrect, because the trial of Euxithios was one among numerous similar trials. Of one such, a part of a defense speech survives. Here, the speaker provides similar argument as Euxithios, and he even states that there is no other way to prove that one is a citizen. Third, Froelich supposes that Euxithios advanced his sharing in Hiera only because he probably had not held a political office. If Euxithios had been, for instance, a member of a jury court, he would have advanced witnesses for that. The fact that he does not would imply that Euxithios probably never had such offices and that he perhaps was not a citizen after all, so Froelich. The scenario Froelich advances here is not impossible, but it's entirely speculative. With this speculation, he wants to invalidate what this speech and the law explicitly state, namely that sharing in the Hiera is essential to citizenship. Fourth, Froelich then points out that the references to the family Hiera in this speech are the same as for legitimacy in inheritance cases. Yes, indeed. Legitimacy for inheritance is exactly what matters here. It is notable that here Froelich observes that Euxithios' arguments fit a pattern, which contradicts what he claimed earlier, that Euxithios was a singular case. More significantly, Froelich apparently missed my central point that citizenship was cast as an inheritance too, not only of family property, but also of one's share in the polis. In contrast to my arguments based on the law, Froelich does not provide any evidence from law, nor does he clarify what he thinks the laws on citizenship that we do have mean for citizenship? In Athens, Pericles' law and its reinstitution that define legitimate descent as the condition for citizen status and for sharing in hierarchousia. All of this reveals, I think, the main problem. Fröhlich does not seem to accept or understand that citizenship begins with membership, to which the various rights of participation are attached. Just like Aristotle, he simply discards membership from the discussion. Savalli Lestrade does not misrepresent my arguments to the same degree as Fröhlich does, but she likewise shows difficulties in understanding the meaning of membership by descent for citizenship. For instance, concerning Demosthenes 57, Savalli Lestrade focuses on Euxithius' office as demarchos and wonders why the man pays more attention to his legitimate descent than to his office. Apparently, she entirely missed the point that legitimate descent is conditional for any prerogative like public office, and that precisely this was at stake here. Of course, we do not need to agree. But since Fröhlich and Savalli Lestrade both clearly misunderstand what I am saying, I wonder why this might be so. Perhaps the core of the problem is that both Fröhlich and Savalli Lestrade are specialists in the epigraphy of the Hellenistic cities, especially of Asia Minor. They refer to inscriptions from the Hellenistic cities they think I should have used, and they hold against me that I hardly used the work of the éminence grise in this field, Philippe Gautier. It seems they have been reading my book about archaic and classical Athens through this Hellenistic lens. Sorry. And that matters, because in the Hellenistic period, some aspects of Greek citizenship changed. For instance, the criterion for membership gradually returned to just one citizen parent. And increasing numbers of people had more than one citizenship. The inscribed citizenship grants in the Hellenistic cities are also different from those in Athens. They feature long lists of prerogatives and privileges that tend to obscure what citizenship grants were, at least originally, gifts of membership as if someone was a born citizen. Despite these differences, I suppose Fröhlich and Savalli Lestrade would agree that ritual exchange with the gods was and remained crucial to civic life in ancient Greece. And such a shared viewpoint would open space for a new discussion about citizenship. Thank you very much.